This is the future.
TalkZone.com, the best in internet talk radio.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
And here they are to the line of scrimmage. Back to throw, Roethlisberger, pump fake short. Airs it out deep, left side point for Wallace. Intercepted on the underthrow by Collins. Right sideline to the 15 to the 10. Weaving his way to the 5. Leaping end zone. It's a touchdown! 35-yard interception return touchdown for Nick Collins, the all-pro. And time melts away. The Super Bowl 45. The title is back in town. The Green Bay Packers are world champions of football.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkish, and along with Eric Edholm, it's our pleasure to bring you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly, where we'll do all we can to put a cap on Super Bowl 45.
We'll break down the labor negotiations, take a look at some recent coaching moves, and examine our NFL Mock Draft 1.0.
Along with all the latest way we hear it, it's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Welcome to our post-Super Bowl edition of Pro Football Weekly. I'm Hub Arkish. Wayne Larrabee is on assignment this week, but Wayne will be back with us next week for our 2010 NFL Season in Review show. Pro Football Weekly senior editor Eric Edholm is in studio with me today. We will be joined by the rest of the editorial staff of Pro Football Weekly in just a few moments. But first, we thought we would take a look back on the celebration at Lambeau, the Green Bay Packers, the 45th world champions of the NFL, at least in the Super Bowl era, and Greg Matzik of the Packers Radio Network filed this report.
The Green Bay Packers' return to Titletown was punctuated when 35,000 fans lined the streets of Green Bay the Monday after the Packers' 31-25 Super Bowl 45 victory over the Pittsburgh Steelers. But this wasn't the official parade. This was simply a couple of buses hauling players from Austin Scrabble Regional Airport to the stadium so the players could get their cars. Welcome to Green Bay. On Tuesday, 50,000 fans braved Arctic temperatures and packed Lambeau Field as the official return to Titletown celebration took place. Coaches and players walked out of Lambeau Field Tunnel for the final time to a thunderous ovation as head coach Mike McCarthy paraded the Vince Lombardi Trophy around the stadium, allowing fans to touch what the Packers had earned.
You're clearly an energy force for our football team. Just keep bringing that passion, that energy, and we'll keep bringing them trophies home back to you. Great job this year.
Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers joined the team on Tuesday after spending Monday at Disney World and then on The Late Show with David Letterman. With bags under his eyes and a giant smile on his face, Rodgers addressed the crowd.
Hey, no, I just want to say that until 2 days ago, the greatest day of my sporting career was April 23rd, 2005, when this organization picked me in the draft. Hey, I just want you to know, for the next year, you guys can steal my belt celebration. Because we're the champions of the world. Put that on whenever you want.
The excitement of Super Bowl 45 may never subside with Green Bay Packers fans, and with the prospects of an unusual offseason on the horizon, the newly christened champions appear to be in great position to weather a potential storm. Quarterback Aaron Rodgers is 27 years old, entering the prime of his career, already among the NFL's elite quarterbacks, and the Packers wisely locked up emerging talents in quarterback Tremont Williams and linebacker Desmond Bishop. Could the Packers be celebrating in Indianapolis next February? There may not be a team in recent memory where the window of opportunity is so wide. For Pro Football Weekly, I'm Greg Matzik.
Well, Greg, thank you very much. And a few more of the Packers stars that the Packer fans were delighted to hear from at Lambeau at that wild celebration. And it starts with a former defensive MVP. Charles Woodson won the award in 2009 and talked about what it took for this Packer team to accomplish this feat.
Well, I think after the Patriot game, going into the New York Giants game here in Lambeau Field, the way that this team responded to that adversity, knowing that if we lost that game, we were out. But we still had a shot at winning it, and we did it. We did it.
They certainly did. And according to Pro Football Weekly and the Pro Football Writers of America, the Packers had another defensive MVP in the NFL this year in second-year linebacker Clay Matthews. And Matthews, well, he just wanted to say thanks.
You know, I really couldn't have done it without my teammates, coaches, the fans, everybody that's been a part of this Packers organization. So really, I contribute all of my success, all the team's success to everybody who's been around this organization, and most importantly, you, the fans.
Well, and one more thank you left very much to the elder statesman of this football team, Donald Driver, I think, had to wonder if he was ever going to get to a Super Bowl, get to win a Super Bowl. The emotion poured out of him all week after the celebration in Dallas, and particularly with the fans in Lambeau.
Oh, we love you guys so much. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to accomplish the things that we accomplished. You guys cheer us on. The 70,000 fans that's in this stadium every Sunday. The million fans watching on TV. We love you guys. Thank you for your support. And guess what? We're Super Bowl champs, baby.
About 1,800 players around the NFL would love to finish the season being able to say that, Eric. And, you know, the week in Dallas was interesting, and there was going to be no losers. Pittsburgh Steelers, good ball club, a lot of good guys. But this Packer team, you just had a feeling, not only a sense that this was a team of destiny, but also good bunch of guys that you kind of couldn't help but feel good for when good things happened to them.
Yeah, it was a young group that came up together. You know, a lot of people questioned the way it was put together by Ted Thompson, but I think chemistry was an important part of that. And for them to overcome all the injuries they did, I mean, two of the guys we just heard from, Woodson and Driver, were on the sideline injured when that game finished. And it was incredible to see some of these young guys step up. And, you know, everybody believed in each other. You know, the next man up, that was kind of their theme all season long. And like you said, easy to root for, easy to like.
You know, Clay Matthews, a superstar after just 2 years in the league, so poised, so at ease with the crowd and with all the Super Bowl hype. You look at Charles Woodson, who early in his career, not bad off the field problems, but he had a lot of growing up to do. He is one of the elder statesmen of this league now and clearly the leader of this football team. And then everywhere you look, on the offensive line, Brian Bulaga stepped in, and at linebacker, Frank Zombo. Who knew who Frank Zombo was? One of the big plays in the second half. The way this team filled holes with injuries was one of the remarkable stories I've seen in 30-plus years on the beat.
And you think about two of their top three cornerbacks, Tremont Williams, Sam Shields, undrafted guys that other teams did not want. I mean, it was incredible to see their ascension, not only in this game, but through the season. I mean, Shields struggled a little bit, but, you know, guys like Jarrett Bush stepped up. I mean, he had to play a big role in the second half there, and pretty remarkable to see them do that from game one all the way through the Super Bowl, having to replace guys on the fly, and, you know, did a fine job of unearthing some great talent from little places.
Well, and Eric, I think Greg Matzik may have touched on it best at the end of his report. This team, when we eventually get to training camp, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, but when the NFL returns to training camps, the Packers are going to be there with 30 starters, and still tons of depth on this football team. It is possible that we saw the beginning of a dynasty in Super Bowl 45.
Yeah, there's no question. I will say this point, that the last time I felt this way about a team after a Super Bowl was the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when they won it. They looked to be a team that could roll and win two or three titles over the next 3 or 4 years. Obviously, their run kind of ended a little quicker than some expected, so it's no guarantee whatsoever.
No guarantees, absolutely, but one big difference, the quarterback.
Yes.
And that may be what's going to separate this team. We're going to take a quick commercial break here. A lot went on Super Bowl week, a lot of collective bargaining conversation. We'll have it for you next on Pro Football Weekly. You're listening to Pro Football Weekly. Wayne Larrabee is out on assignment, but Wayne will be back with us next week. I'm Hub Arkish. PFW senior editor Eric Edholm is in the studio this week, and Eric was also with us in Dallas, as were a number of the members of the Pro Football Weekly editorial staff. And Eric, one more quick story before we get to collective bargaining, which of course was almost the overriding subject over the Super Bowl last week. The ticket fiasco at the game. Folks, if you haven't seen it yet, go to ProFootballWeekly.com. Eric had a brilliant piece with a young lady, a middle-aged lady from Barrington, Illinois, who was one of the people, one of the 400, who did not get seats, had taken her two brothers as a reward for being cancer survivors to the Super Bowl, spent over $20,000, and just told kind of a heart-wrenching story about what went wrong.
Yeah, it was a congratulations, you beat cancer trip. Supposed to be a trip of a lifetime. She got there, ended up waiting in 2 hours worth of security lines, only to find out that her tickets were no good. So by the time she got back out to the ticket office to exchange and then went back through security and got back up to the last row of the stadium, you know, she had missed half of the first quarter. And when you pay that kind of price to go to the Super Bowl, which the NFL presents as its ultimate experience, you're going to come back a little upset. And she told us her story, and it's an unfortunate one.
Well, and you listen, people make mistakes. Yeah. We understand that. And there's now some debate. Is the NFL doing enough, too much, or going over the top to try and make good? Here's something we do know from this lady and other people we've talked to. The idea that 850 people were relocated to equal or better seats is a lie. Not
yes.
true. They did not get equal or better seats, and many of them are part of this now class action group of over 1,000 who are suing the NFL. Beyond that, could this have been avoided? Yes, it could have been avoided. Did the league act appropriately during the game? No, they did not. Is the league doing everything they can after the fact? Maybe they are. That I can't judge. They've got a no-win situation, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we have to mention there were several Cowboys employees, several NFL employees who gave up their seats for the game. It's a nice gesture. It was an on-the-fly kind of thing. But, you know, they're in the middle of CBA talks, and there's a lot of people working on that right now. And so this ticket thing maybe has taken a bit of a backseat in the big picture.
Well, and I will say one thing. The guy who I think is getting a bad rap, and for those of you who listen a lot, it's probably the first time in 30 years I've defended Jerry Jones. Now, he has some culpability here. Yep. He clearly is involved. But this is not on him. The league takes over the venue and the week once the Super Bowl starts. This is on the NFL offices. This is not really on Jerry Jones and the Dallas Cowboys. They bear a portion of the responsibility, but they are not the ones who are guilty here.
I think Jones might be guilty of wanting to set the attendance record, which may have forced some things to not get approved and, you know, try to jam in more seats than were possible. But you're right. The NFL is the most culpable in this situation.
Eric, the story all week long in Super Bowl, and the only story we're going to hear over the next, hopefully, couple months, maybe 5, 6, 7 months, we hope it doesn't get there, is collective bargaining. Roger Goodell and DeMaurice Smith both spent quite a bit of time with the media trying to get their message out. And I think we start with the commissioner, who told us at his press conference on Friday that he certainly understands the need to get something done and to get it done quickly.
I frequently said that I think that March 4th is a very critical date. Because, again, a lot of different strategies will take place if we're not successful in getting an agreement by that time. We need to have intensive round-the-clock negotiations to address the issues and find solutions. If we're committed to doing that, I think we can be successful, but we have to demonstrate that commitment and get to work.
So here's problem number one, Eric. Great news in Dallas. They had an impromptu session that they scheduled on Saturday, agreed to schedule a series of meetings leading up to March 4th. The first one took place the Wednesday following the Super Bowl. The two sides came out of the Wednesday meeting and, according to our sources, canceled the Thursday meeting. We know they canceled it, according to our sources, because they were so far apart, they figured, what's the sense in talking? So that is completely opposed to what we just heard Roger Goodell say.
And you have to wonder how much they got done at all in the first place. The Saturday meeting was probably more of a goodwill thing. It lasted all of 2 hours. You know, the Wednesday session, clearly they found out just how far apart they are. And so, you know, the clock is ticking here, and we've got to decide how much they can actually get done in the next couple of weeks.
One of the concerns a number of us as reporters had at the Super Bowl was NFL Players Association Executive Director DeMaurice Smith. At times, sounded like anything but a guy who wants to get a deal done. He was radical. He was hardcore. But he did tell us what he thought needed to happen, what needs to be in this next collective bargaining agreement.
So a fair deal is one that not only has to be fair today, it has to be fair for the players tomorrow. A fair deal not only can be fair today, it has to be fair to the people who have made this game. So we should be thinking about ways that we not only grow the game, but we grow the game in a way that takes care of the players who made this game the success that it is.
Now, in fairness, and forget fairness, let's just call this accurate reporting, the players didn't want any part of this. They have offered repeatedly to continue to play under the agreement that the owners are opting out of early, and DeMaurice Smith is his own worst enemy, because I think the players have got the high ground here, and he keeps giving it back by trying to be this, you know, reactive revolutionary who just wants to fight.
Watching that press conference, I felt like he looked like an underdog and was acting like an underdog, like a cat kind of backed into a corner a little bit, maybe realizing that the owners have the financial strength in this whole deal. But, yeah, it seemed like a very adversarial position as opposed to one that was trying to come together on something.
Well, and let's be honest, folks, this is about money. This is about the owners wanting more than $1 billion back, but $1 billion off the top. But the second hot-button issue is the idea of an 18-game schedule, and this is where you talk about ceding the high ground. When asked about it at his State of the Union or State of the League press conference on Friday, Roger Goodell said this about the 18-game schedule.
Well, we started this with the fans. The fans have clearly stated that they don't like the quality of our preseason. As you know, our structure is a 20-game format. We have 4 preseason games and 16 regular season games. And repeatedly, fans have said the quality of the preseason doesn't meet NFL standards. And that is one of the basis of which we started to look at the 18-2 concept, by taking 2 of those low-quality, non-competitive games and turn those into quality, competitive games that the fans want to see, they want to support.
Eric, Roger Goodell is not a liar. I'm comfortable with that. They may have started looking at it for that reason, but that has absolutely nothing to do with what is going on right now. The owners want the two games because it's money. It's more money that they want a bigger share of, and to pretend that it's not more stress on the players, that playing 18 regular season and 2 preseason is the same as 16 regular and 4 preseason, that is not true. And that's where Roger Goodell is starting to lose some credibility.
Yeah, I think fans would say, yeah, we don't want 4 preseason games, but they're not standing out there and picketing for 18 games. They're not saying that this is something that we have to have. I mean, the polls have shown, not even just union polls, polls from from neutral sources have said that fans are almost indifferent on this thing. I think they're a little confused by the need for an 18-game schedule. They like the symmetry of 16, so I agree. This has been spun in a different direction to help the league.
Well, and the fans I talked to, Eric, are very clear. They'd like 16-2.
Yeah.
Which costs the owners money. Yeah. It doesn't generate more, and that's why that's not going to happen. Folks, it doesn't look good in the short term. We will be reporting on this every week for you. Hopefully it'll get better soon. We're going to talk some football in just a moment. Welcome back. As we roll on with Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish and Eric Edholm with you in studio. We will now visit with a number of members of the Pro Football Weekly editorial staff as we bring you The Way We Hear It, hot off of Super Bowl 45. And we'll start with senior editor Mike Wilkening. And the Tennessee Titans have a new head football coach in Mike Munchak, and he didn't waste any time in stirring the waters a little bit. Fires offensive coordinator Mike Heimerdinger. He brings back a former teammate and Hall of Famer, Bruce Matthews, to coach his offensive line, not letting any grass grow under his feet down in Nashville.
No, certainly, and I think that this was kind of the first move for Mike Munchak to put his stamp on the Tennessee Titans. This is a team that, having a new sideline boss for the first time in quite some time, with Jeff Fisher no longer there, it's going to be a different look, and a new defensive coordinator going to be in place, obviously Chuck Cecil having moved on, and obviously a change in offensive coordinator. So it's going to be very interesting to see the type of philosophy that the Titans have on both sides of the ball this year.
You know, Mike, it's interesting to me, Greg Williams, a guy with significant coordinator experience, a guy with head coaching experience. Munchak has never even been a coordinator. It's almost like this was Bud Adams' favorite son who got this job before the interview process really even started. What's the reaction in Nashville to this decision?
Well, I think Mike Munchak is a guy that's very well respected as a position coach. And, you know, as it stood in Tennessee, there was somebody always in the coordinator job, and he sort of, did a wonderful job with the O-line and really kind of gained acclaim that way. From all accounts, very respected position coach, probably ready for that jump. He was probably ready to be an offensive coordinator, you would say, years ago. It was just kind of circumstance that sort of had him in that particular position. He excelled as a position coach. We've seen it before where guys have been position coaches and excelled as head coaches. So I get the sense that this was a guy that was probably ready for more responsibility, and obviously close ties to the franchise, being somebody that had played in Houston and obviously had coached in Tennessee for so many years. I think it was a move that made sense.
All right, hang on for just a second, Wilkie. I want to talk to Eric about one of his ball clubs, the Minnesota Vikings. The Star Caps farce is over. The courts have finally ruled, isn't it coincidence, right after the end of the season, 2 years later. Players lose. The league had the right all along to mandate or institute its drug policy. Now it looks like the Williams wall, if Pat Williams is back in Minnesota, will serve their 4-game suspension. Deuce McAllister's been out of football for a while. Charles Grant's out of football. We don't know what happens with Will Smith. But now for the Vikings, not only that, but Everson Griffin, one of the young defensive linemen brought in to spell them, grow behind them, arrested not once but twice during the offseason, has avoided felony charges. Looks like maybe he shouldn't have avoided felony charges. So Vikings have got a mess on their hands on the defensive front.
Yeah, I mean, what was unquestioned strength for so many years now is a major question potentially heading into 2011. You know, Griffin probably sticks around. I think Rick Spielman doesn't want to have the egg on his face for that draft pick, wants to see him work out. Kid did emerge a little bit at the end of the season. So the question is whether Ray Edwards is back. The defensive end wants to cash in as a free agent. That could mean Jared Allen is the only defensive lineman back from next season to start the year. So, you know, LaTroy Guyon and Jimmy Kennedy at tackle, they're just kind of guys. So I'm curious to see, does that change the need? in draft time to defensive tackle. It's one of their huge voids.
Well, and Pat Williams was thought to be ready for retirement. Instead announced he wants to play at least two more years. No clarity on whether the Vikings will re-sign him or not. And you know, with him possibly gone, with Kevin Williams probably suspended the first four games, there's extra pressure to bring Ray Edwards back. So we will watch that story very closely. Wilkie, on your side, the Cleveland Browns, another one of your ball clubs. Six players cut primarily for salary cap reasons. We assume there'll be a cap on the other side of the CBA mess. And the one surprising but not so surprising, Sean Rogers, due $5.5 million dollars in 2011. Still a Pro Bowl type player, although suffered with a lot of injuries and a lot of downtime in 2010. He is now a free agent.
He is. He's an interesting guy in the sense that when he's been at his best, he's been a Pro Bowl type player. He had some nagging injuries this year. Was a guy that didn't start. Really, a Tyber Rubin, the nose tackle, took a big step forward for them this year. And really, I think kind of made Sean Rogers the release possible and kind of, you know, pushed Sean Rogers into sort of a smaller role. He's a guy capable still of taking over games in spurts. Look at the way he played against New Orleans in that upset. Cleveland's probably signature win other than their win against the Patriots this year. He's capable of doing some things. It just kind of depends upon the type of role that he's going to be forecast to play for whatever team he ends up. But he's a guy that still does not lack for talent. It's just a matter of what type of role does he fit into, what type of defense does he fit into.
When Sean Rogers wants to play, he's a force, but his nickname, Big Baby. We'll see where Big Baby ends up next. We've got more Way We Hear It in just a moment. And we are talking Way We Hear It here on Pro Football Weekly. A lot of news coming out of a week in Dallas at the Super Bowl. We're now joined by Associate Editor Michael Blunda. And one of Michael's teams, the Kansas City Chiefs, has a new offensive coordinator. Charlie Weiss, of course, left to go to back to college to be at Florida. And some people thought he left before the playoffs, but that's a different story for a different time. But Michael, what's so interesting is with the hiring of Bill Muir, a veteran offensive line coach, it looks like Todd Haley is going to be at least in part his own coordinator.
That's certainly what it seems like. How Bill Muir has been around forever. He's been an offensive coordinator in places like Tampa Bay, but when he was there, he was with John Gruden, who was the guy calling plays. It seems like that's probably going to be a similar situation in Kansas City. Todd Haley, obviously an experienced play caller, most likely will continue doing that with Bill Muir contributing to the game plans mostly. They wanted him around for continuity reasons, which you can understand, but it doesn't sound like he's going to have an enormous role in terms of the play calling.
Michael, how much have we learned, if anything, about these reports that there was a tension between Haley and Weiss and that they really weren't getting along for the better part, at least the second half of the season?
Well, we had heard that by the end of the year, Haley was actually calling a fair amount of the plays himself, and we don't really know exactly why, if they had butted heads regarding play calling throughout the season, and you know, Haley just decided that he was going to take some on his own shoulders. It certainly seemed like there was just it was too big of egos to have them both around at the same time. So Charlie Weiss just saw an opportunity to leave, and he took it.
Michael, thank you very much. Eric, I got to talk to you a little bit about the Washington Redskins. And I don't mean to snicker, but I don't know where to start with this story. Daniel Snyder, there was an announcement at the annual meeting of the Pro Football Writers of America that Snyder would be at the back of the room after the meeting to make himself available to reporters, which is unusual, first, for him to make himself available to reporters. But the fact that he wanted us to know, he wanted to talk to us, there were reports that he was considering suing a local Washington, D.C. publication over something a writer had written, which seemed, you know, kind of negative but benign enough. And then, you know, he takes responsibility for the Albert Haynesworth fiasco. What, if anything, have we learned new or significant about Daniel Snyder?
Well, I almost fell off my chair when I heard the announcement, too, Hub. But, you know, a small group of us went and talked to him, and you know, he talked openly about McNabb and Haynesworth and the trouble this season and took responsibility for writing the check for Haynesworth, obviously disappointed in the production. Still believes, though, that both guys, in theory, could come back. And that was probably the most surprising thing. But then again, what's he supposed to say? You know, I mean, he's got to put a good face on this. They want to try to at least see what the trade value is for those guys. I'll give Snyder this. He's trying. He's trying to reach out. The newspaper story, the potential lawsuit there, he said they went after his wife, and unfairly so, and I can understand a guy being upset. He said he just wanted an apology. But as far as with the media, with the fans, he is at least reaching out. He says he's a different guy than when he was 35 when he bought the team. He's 46 now. Appears to have matured somewhat, I guess.
Well, I will tell you this. If, in fact, the story did go after his wife, then I support him wholeheartedly. But there's people who would argue that point. So, you know, we'll just have to see how that one plays out. We now welcome in Associate Editor Arthur Arkish, who also was in Dallas with us for Super Bowl 45. But Arthur, one of your clubs, the Jacksonville Jaguars, has been making stories about as far away from Dallas as you can get. And we continue to hear reports that this franchise is going to be sold after a collective bargain agreement is reached. And one of the reasons is all the cost cutting that's going on. And now a couple embarrassments. None of their assistants are signed beyond 2011. Mike Shula left to go to Carolina. That in part to join a buddy of his. Him and Ron Rivera started as young coaches together in Chicago in the mid-90s. But now Todd Monken, who was promoted to replace Shula as the quarterback coach, had the job for a week or two, and he's left. So what's going on in Jacksonville?
Well, as you mentioned, we have been hearing that Weaver was trying to clear the books for a potential sale after a new CBA had been reached, but this has obviously backfired. These guys clearly don't like the fact that they didn't have much job security, and they've found better choices, and now the Jaguars are kind of left looking for what will be their third quarterback coach of the offseason, so it's going to be interesting to see where they go from here.
Are we hearing from Jack Del Rio at all? Now, he's the only guy. He's got 2 years left, but he's the guy who's in the most trouble. What's he doing about getting a staff that works?
Well, that's a great question, and his hands are going to be tied at this point. It's going to be kind of hard to, to get a guy with a real resume when you can't offer him anything beyond this season. So Del Rio's going to have his hands full, but as you mentioned, Weaver's kind of put him in this position, and clearly this is what he has to deal with. So.
All right, Arthur, sit tight for just a moment. We want to talk to you about the Indianapolis Colts as well. We'll do that on the other side, as well as bringing Dan Arkish and Eric back for more Way We Hear It. Pro Football Weekly coming at you. I'm Hub Arkish. Wayne Larrabee is out on assignment, but Wayne will be back next week for our 2010 NFL Season in Review show. Our senior editor, Eric Edholm, is alongside in studio, as well as a number of members of the PFW editorial staff. But, Eric, I want to start with you. The Philadelphia Eagles waited 3-4 weeks to name a new defensive coordinator and then just knocked our socks off when offensive line coach Juan Castillo, 13 years on the offensive line, is the new defensive coordinator. What is Andy Reid doing there?
Yeah, it was definitely a surprise. Reid came back from vacation. There was a sense from people I had talked to, they were waiting for one of the Super Bowl teams to finish, or actually both Super Bowl teams. There was talk about defensive coordinator candidates on both clubs possibly coming in to interview. And then in Super Bowl week, they said Castillo's got the job. He hasn't really done much with the defensive side of the ball since he was a linebacker in college in 1990. So this was a shock. The most interesting comment I heard down there was talking to Rams head coach Steve Spagnuolo, of course, was on that staff for about 6-7 years down there, good friends with Castillo. But he said, look, when you know, this is a passing league, and when you understand pass protections, you also understand how to break them. They want to get to that Jim Johnson style of blitzing. It didn't work out with Sean McDermott. Maybe Castillo's got a different perspective on things that could allow him to be a pretty good candidate.
Now, I heard this. I don't know if it's correct. Is it true that the legendary Jimmy Johnson had not coached defense till he became the coordinator as well?
That's correct. He was at Notre Dame in 1977. He had never coached defense before. Obviously a little different level, but that was when Notre Dame was just sort of reaching its powers with Joe Montana and company. So he did a few things right, and a lot of people have talked about that comparison.
All right, let's get Associate Editor Arthur Arkish back. And Arthur, another one of your clubs, the Indianapolis Colts, some people believe Green Bay Packers light. I mean, this is a team that had as many injuries, didn't get to the Super Bowl, but they did get to the first round of the playoffs. Some folks say they're a team in decline. Others think that with the experience these guys got, they could be that much better and a real force in 2011. But now we hear owner Jimmy Irsay saying, there are big changes coming. We know that Peyton Manning is a free agent. They're not going to let him get away, but that big contract he was supposed to get is now starting to look like a franchise tag. Do we know what Irsay means by big changes in Indianapolis?
Well, it's tough to say. Mr. Irsay has certainly gotten the Indy fans rattled on more than one occasion with his tweets that he's been making for several months now. Again, it's really tough to say exactly what he's referring to, but there are a couple guys on that roster right now who really have not lived up to expectations. Obviously, Bob Sanders has never played a full season, has never played more than six games since 2007. He's already banked $20 million in guaranteed money, but he's owed, I believe, just over $5 million for next season, and there's talk that if he's not going to restructure that that deal. He will not be back with the team. A few other guys, Ryan Deem is owed another $5.5 million, really did not play well. Kelvin Hayden was hurt and did not play well. He's owed $6 million. So, again, this is somewhat speculation, but there are guys who really have not lived up to expectations, and we'll just have to see what's going to happen there.
All right, Arthur, thank you much. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I wonder what Jimmy Irsay thinks of Jay Cutler's toughness, but that's another subject for another time. Let's get Arthur's uncle, Dan Arkish, in. Dan, of course, our executive editor, and Dan's got the Green Bay Packers amongst his ball clubs. And, Dan, we don't want to throw cold water on the party, but the one big decision this team does have coming in the offseason, arguably, not arguably, factually, their best defensive lineman, Cullen Jenkins, is going to be a free agent. What do you see happening there?
Well, that's going to be really interesting, Hub, because the one thing with Cullen Jenkins, as talented as he is, he does have injury issues. He has a knack for, you know, in 2008, he got off to a blazing start before suffering a season-ending pectoral injury in the fourth game. This past season, he was out for five games with assorted injuries, the latest one, the last one being a calf injury that knocked him out for the last month of the season. And so if you look at the Packers' track record, I mean, Aaron Kampman most recently, who had his injury issues, I mean, Jenkins has been around now for 7 years, and he's at that age, you know, where it might be, it's going to be really a tough decision on Ted Thompson's part.
Dan, I'm going to throw one at you out of the blue. This team, everybody believes, is going to be the most talented defending champion we've ever seen with all the healthy players they're going to get back. What do you expect them to address during the draft? I mean, where does this team still want to get better?
Well, I think you have to start with that defensive line because you've got both Jenkins and Ryan Pickett, and they're older guys. You've got young guys like Mike Neal, who looked really good, but he might be a guy who has a problem with injuries. You know, he was had problems in college, and he went on injured reserve this year, so you're not real sure about him. They've all but given up on former first-round pick Justin Harrell. So I really think that the defensive line could be where they're looking. Beyond that, I think as good as that secondary is, I mean, as great as it is, I think they might be looking for some more depth there.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We've got more coming up. Mock Draft 1.0. It's draft time already here at Pro Football Weekly. We've got it for you in just a moment. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly, everyone. We are now joined by senior editor and our own Pro Football Weekly talent analyst, par excellence, Nolan Naraki. And it's mock draft time. Now, folks, mock drafts are a ton of fun. They create a lot of conversation. They give you an idea of who the highly rated players are. They also change repeatedly, time after time, leading up to the draft. But we got to start somewhere. And Mock Draft 1.0 from Nolan is available at ProFootballWeekly.com. Also, our NFL Draft Guide magazine will be on your newsstands in just about 15 days. Nolan, welcome so much to the program. And I don't even want to go 1, 2, 3, but I want to look first at the top 5, 6 guys. Now, this doesn't mean they're the 5, 6 best players in the draft. When you try and match up team needs and talent, what they might do, you've got Daquan Bowers, defensive end from Clemson, Marcel Darius, defensive tackle from Alabama, Patrick Peterson, cornerback from LSU, Adre Green, a wide receiver from Georgia, the only offensive player in your top 7, and then you look at number 5, Von Miller from Texas A&M. Looks like at the top end going to be a defensive draft, huh?
It definitely does, Hub. I think Daquan Bowers is the top pass rusher in this draft. He's got outstanding power, outstanding strength. You can really play him anywhere along the defensive line. And I think he's going to be a guy that could potentially replace Julius Peppers in Carolina. They had a hard time without him this year, and he's a guy that can create pressure from a number of spots. So I think it starts with Daquan Bowers.
It's keeping on the defensive side of the ball, Nolan. One of the things that stood out to me when I looked down your list of 32 teams, 9 defensive linemen, 3-4 outside linebackers. So essentially more than a third of the first round is committed to stopping the run and rushing the passer. Is that more of a reflection of where the league is going as a whole, or is it more of a reflection of where the strength in this draft lies?
I think it's both, Eric. You look at the defensive linemen, there's 8 defensive ends that could factor in the first round. And, you know, there's a number of pass rushers. Even on the other side of the ball, you look at the offensive line. I have 8 offensive linemen that are projected to go in the first round as well. So it's really 2/3 of the first round that are either designed to protect the passer or rush the passer. And I think that's where the premium is in the NFL today.
Right, Nolan, now one of the things that really jumped out at me, and again, folks, mock draft 1.0. This is going to change a number of times over the next couple months. But in your first attempt, you've got four quarterbacks in the first round, three in the top 15, and three going ahead of Jake Locker, who many thought out of Washington could be the best quarterback in the bunch. You've got Blaine Gabbert out of Missouri first with Tennessee with the eighth pick, Cam Newton with the Redskins with the 10th pick, Ryan Mallett out of Arkansas going to the Dolphins at 15, and then Locker going to the Seahawks staying home at 25. Tell us a little bit. We know there's a premium at the position, but other reasons that you've got all these kids so high.
Really, it's the premium. You know, if it were me drafting, there's two that I'd be looking at in the first round, Blaine Gabbert and Jake Locker, and I wouldn't be as interested in Locker until later in the first round. To me, Cam Newton and Ryan Mallett have busts screaming all over their names, and, you know, if it were me drafting, I wouldn't touch them until the third or fourth round, even consider them. But, you know, obviously they're going to be pushed up. They'll both likely fit into the first round, no later than the second. But anybody that does their due diligence and does the homework and really studies what kind of makeup and character these kids have, I think they'll be very disappointed.
Now, we talked about it being a passing league. You have only one running back in your first round, Mark Ingram from Alabama. Didn't have as good a senior year as he did as a junior, but is there another runner who could challenge him as being the top back? Is there somebody else who could sneak into the back end of the first round? Or is this pretty much a one and done, we'll have to wait to the second round kind of position?
I think it's Ingram, and then there's a big cliff. You know, there's some other backs that I like. Kendall Hunter from Oklahoma State, you know, he's barely 5'7", 200 pounds, and I don't know that you could take a guy like that in the first round. Even Ingram didn't have a great junior year, so, you know, you look at that position, and there's not much talent there. Even at the receiver position, there's only two receivers, A.J. Green and Julio Jones, that really factor as high draft picks, and I think after that there's a big cliff. So, you know, at the skill positions, I think the talent is definitely down this year.
Prince Amukamara. Actually, I just like saying his name. But beyond that, Nolan, we've got to wrap up here. This is a kid that I hear pushed all over the first round, really varying reports on the big cornerback coming out of Nebraska.
Yeah, the interesting thing is he didn't have a single interception as a senior, and I think we saw him get exposed against Justin Blackmon against Oklahoma State down the field. To me, he's going to be best in a cover two system. You know, I see him as a top 15 pick, and I think he'll be the second cornerback drafted.
Nolan, thank you very much. Nolan Naraki, our Pro Football Weekly NFL College Draft expert, and we'll check in with Nolan regularly as we lead up to the draft. Right now, a quick break, and then we're back with the Publisher's Pen.
And now with the Publisher's Pen, Hub Arkish.
Eric, thank you very much, and I think we have to put a not only a period but an exclamation point on Super Bowl 45 in Dallas. And where I start, the people of Dallas were outstanding. The Super Bowl host committee, the run-up, all the planning, it really was excellent. And I don't want to hang these people for weather. It was an act of God. It was something nobody could have predicted. The fiasco at the stadium, the ticket fiasco, that's on the league. Number of things that went wrong, but the bottom line is Dallas tried, and they get big points from me for that. The problem I have is, are we going to learn from history or are we going to be fools? You couldn't expect that weather in Dallas, but here's what we know. That weather is the best you can hope for this year in Indianapolis and again in 2 years in New York when there's no roof on the stadium. The Super Bowl has to be played in a warm weather site or at least predictable conditions so that you can have a great week. What happens if they get a blizzard in Indy or New York like they did in Indy and Chicago last week? It's going to be a disaster. Too late to change Indy. They got to rethink New York. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly. Our thanks to the Packers Radio Network. Randy Meyer is our engineer and executive producer par excellence, and Syndication Network, our home studios. Most of all, we want to thank all of you for listening. We appreciate it so much and ask you to be there next week, same time, same station, for more Pro Football Weekly.